You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 15, Novels as Spycraft Part 4, J.D. Salinger, the CIC, Nazis, Brainwashing, and the Exoteric Message of Freemasonry. Today I'm recording from the Dakota Apartments in New York City. To respond to Teleschism's question, yet again, I am exploring novels as spycraft, right? And I highlighted two categories, novels that seem to discuss or expose spy narratives, and novels that seem to spread interesting or esoteric views to the public, right? However, there is a third category. The third category is novels that happen to figure prominently in conspiracies, whether intentional or not. Now, for my money, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye is the gold standard for this category. The novel has major themes of alienation and angst, and it showed up in a bunch of real, actual conspiracies and high-profile assassinations. But let's take the time to look at J.D. Salinger himself. We're going to take a conventional look at his history, and then, because I love you, dear listeners, then I will dredge up some interesting tidbits that are technically part of the tapestry, but that most people maybe don't encounter when they, you know, read through his work and maybe skim his Wikipedia page, right? And I should say that I've read all of J.D. Salinger's works when I was younger, and that's not to be like, ah, yes, I only read Salinger when I was younger. But I mean, my interests change, right? Like, you move on. You shouldn't keep rereading the same things you read when you were a kid. And I liked Salinger's fiction as far as it goes. I'm not sure how much I would enjoy it now, and that's separate from what I learned in researching this episode. But, you know, Salinger came out of Columbia University's writing program. And he's very much in the vein of the literature that I eventually swerved in favor of, like, basically Latin American literature and Thomas Pynchon. Like, if you mention John Updike to me, like, I will fight you. So to get started, J.D. Salinger was born in 1919 in Manhattan to a Lithuanian Jewish family. They were kind of embarrassed about being Jewish, and they tried to assimilate into the WASPs of New York City. Salinger's daughter, Margaret Salinger, said that the whole subject of Jewishness is something my father is very touchy about indeed. And to an extent, I mean, I think that might be partially a generational thing. And, like, it's interesting, actually, because when I think about Salinger's, like, the world of Salinger stories, I think New York City WASPs, not Jews. In fact, only two of his stories have Jewish references or themes at all. Except in the broad, general way, I suppose. Salinger's fictional Glass family were actually Irish Catholics, a different ethnic group somewhat on the outside of WASPs, therefore related but different to his direct experiences. And of course, in the stories, the Glass family were themselves attempting to integrate into the New York City WASP scene, right? So it's like, similar but not entirely the same, right? Now, these themes are complicated, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about, like, Jewish identity, because, you know, I'm not Jewish. Someone else can talk about this. There is some interesting stuff about denying your heritage or whatever, but again, I'll leave that to someone else, and it's outside the point of this episode. So, Salinger was drafted into World War II, and he saw combat during D-Day, during the D-Day invasion. Though Salinger was Jewish, he did not identify with the Austrian and German Jews and did not talk about their plight, like before, during, or even really after, that much after World War II. When news of the Final Solution was first publicized in May 1942, and then it was truly widespread by like December 1942, at least in the United States, Salinger never talked about it with his army buddies or in his letters. In his letters back home, Salinger only ever really wrote about literature. And, like, this was probably a coping mechanism, right? And a helpful distraction from the war. I'm not saying any of this as judgment, by the way. It's just fascinating. Now, Salinger wanted to be an officer, but the army did not accept him as one. Therefore, he applied to work in CIC, the Army's Counterintelligence Corps. You can't see me, dear listener, but I am smiling right now. smiling knowingly. Now, informally, Salinger was part of what was known as the Ritchie Boys. They were called Ritchie Boys because they were trained at Camp Ritchie in Maryland for counterintelligence, right? Now, Salinger was useful in this capacity because he spoke French and German. It's important to note that he was not a CIC officer. Now, the CIC unit that Salinger was assigned to was involved with tricking the Wehrmacht with regard to landing spots for D-Day. What's more, Salinger saw some shit, like, outside of combat. He and his unit were ordered to help cover up several major disasters around this time. His unit was present for Exercise Tiger. Exercise Tiger was a practice landing exercise carried out by 30,000 troops. Like, imagine that. During Exercise Tiger, due to poor coordination and planning, and I quote, more than 100 soldiers had been killed by friendly fire from a British warship, and more than 600 soldiers and sailors had been killed when a German torpedo boat sank two large landing ships and crippled a third. These tragedies were due to shoddy planning on the part of the Army and Navy leadership, due to an unwise decision by the admiral in charge, and due to a lack of communication between the British Navy and the American troops, unquote. Salinger's unit guarded the local hospitals where the surviving men from Exercise Tiger were being treated. Their job was to make sure that none of them talked about Exercise Tiger and the D-Day plans, and also ensuring the silence of the doctors and nurses. Now, the U.S. Armed Forces temporarily covered up the U-boat deaths of the 600 until after D-Day, which, like, that's understandable. But they permanently covered up the friendly fire incident where 100 U.S. soldiers, 100 plus U.S. soldiers, were killed by British ships. This was only uncovered 45 years after the fact by a British historian named Nigel Lewis. Now, the previous passage I read from and this passage are from the book J.D. Salinger and the Nazis, and I quote it again. Exercise Tiger had turned out to be a more realistic introduction to the horrors of war than Salinger could have expected. After all, he and his CIC detachment might all have been wounded or killed if they had been part of the second assault wave and not the first. Having been spared this close call must have seemed especially fortunate to Salinger when he witnessed even more horrific carnage caused by the attack of the German torpedo boats on the LSTs, on the transport ships. I suspect that Salinger later came to see that the casualties at Slapton Sands were unnecessary because they resulted from the incompetence of military leadership, unquote. Now, to be clear, Salinger was not a CIC officer, and the decision to cover this up was way above his pay grade. So I'm not telling this story as a black mark against him, necessarily. If anything, he was caught up in broader events than he could control or maybe even understand. Now, before D-Day, Salinger wrote, in April of 1944, I was among some 60 American enlisted men who took a rather specialized pre-invasion training course directed by British intelligence in Devon, England, unquote. The course lasted 3 weeks, after which they were sent to London, where they were to be assigned to infantry and airborne divisions mustered for the D-Day landings. Note here that J.D. Salinger was exposed and trained by British intelligence after already being a U.S. Army CIC corporal. I'm not implying that this carries more weight than it does, but it's not nothing, either. During D-Day, Salinger was on Utah Beach. They were not direct combat troops, but they were definitely being fired upon and returning fire. Still, it would be better to be on Utah Beach than, like, Omaha Beach. Part of his unit's responsibility was to interrogate those captured in the immediate aftermath of D-Day. J.D. Salinger's daughter quoted him as saying, I landed on D-Day, you know, he would say to me darkly, soldier to soldier, as it were, as if I understood the unspoken implications. Margaret also described her father remembering D-Day while watching a group of young men doing construction work on his new home in New Hampshire. He said, all those big strong boys, always on the front lines, always the first to be killed, wave after wave of them. Now, dear listener, If you were to read the glowing, dare I say, hagiographic biography, J.D. Salinger, A Life, by the biographer Kenneth Slowenski. Slowenski claims that Salinger regularly fought the Wehrmacht alongside the combat troops of the 12th Infantry Regiment. Slowenski wrote, "Although an intelligence agent, once upon the field of battle, he was forced to become a leader of men, responsible for the safety and actions of squadrons and platoons. The lives of his fellow soldiers depended on the orders he gave." The author of J.D. Salinger and the Nazis, Eberhard Alsen, wrote, "This statement contains two errors of fact. First of all, Salinger's CIC detachment never participated in combat because they did rear echelon work well behind the front lines. Second, Salinger was not a leader of men responsible for squads and platoons. During the first 3 months of D-Day, he was a lowly corporal and did not regain his earlier rank of staff sergeant until late in August 1944. Even as a staff sergeant in the CIC, he was not a leader of men. The only soldier Salinger was responsible for was his driver." Now, if we were to consult the large and encyclopedic book, The History and Mission of the Counterintelligence Corps in World War II, we could find out what duties the CIC detachments actually had. And according to that book, it was the task of the CIC to, quote, "combat espionage, sabotage, and subversion, to prevent leakage of information to the enemy, and to deliver security lectures to the troops." More specifically, the book says, "Counterintelligence Corps detachments were to perform tactical counterintelligence corps functions such as search of enemy command posts and the questioning of civilians, informers, and agents in occupied territory. The Army detachment was to conduct rear echelon missions, including safeguarding military information, security against the activities of enemy agents, and rear echelon counterintelligence functions in general." Unquote. So that's the type of work that Salinger was doing in France after D-Day. And to be clear, this mostly entailed boring patrols, checking papers, and checking the mail. From D-Day on, Salinger did not see combat. Salinger also witnessed the 8th U.S. Air Force bomb American troops at the Saint-Lô-Perrier Highway on July 25, 1944. This incident resulted in 111 U.S. soldiers killed by friendly fire. We know that Salinger was near enough to witness it. We do not know if the CIC was ordered to cover it up, like at Slapton Sands with Exercise Tiger. But it is likely, actually, that they might have been involved in helping cover it up as well. And of course, covering it up can mean a lot of things, whether it means, you know, an outright cover-up, or just hiding the most damning aspects, or just, you know, helping facilitate an inquiry happening after the war, right? Now, Salinger was there for the liberation of Paris, and he wrote about what a beautiful day it was. In a letter, he wrote that the Parisians' happiness at being liberated made things seem more worthwhile, because he had gradually become more and more jaded about the war. Around this time, Salinger was able to meet Ernest Hemingway in Paris. He said, "He's very soft, not at all big-shoddy or patronizing, and he's modest without affection." Hemingway said of Salinger, "Jesus, he has a hell of a talent." Margaret Salinger, his daughter, also told of an incident that troubled him deeply when he witnessed the lynching of a suspected Nazi collaborator. Margaret said, "My father told me that he and his driver arrested a suspected collaborator, but the crowd spotted the man, tore him from their arms, and beat him to death on the spot. My father said there was nothing, short of gunning down the entire crowd, that could have stopped them." According to Margaret's account of the incident, Salinger's impulse was to stop them. Now, as a CIC agent, Salinger's job was to deal with French citizens denouncing each other as Nazi collaborators. He had seen enough false denunciations to know that many were motivated by self-interest and personal grudges rather than reality. Now, after the liberation of Paris, Salinger's unit was involved in the Battle of the Hürgen Forest, which was before but related to the Battle of the Bulge, right? And in this battle, he was under fire but was not direct combat, right? So in this sense, you could say he saw more combat, but did not participate in combat. This battle was one of the larger Wehrmacht counteroffensive that attempted to turn the tide of the war. This battle is also notable for US literature because Kurt Vonnegut was actually captured and became a POW in the same overall counteroffensive. He was caught up in these battles as well. Now, it would be too much work for me to explain why the battle was a huge fuck up by the US Army, but just take my word for it. You know, it's debatable, but that's how a lot of the soldiers felt about it. And that's how Salinger felt about it too. And he witnessed it on the intelligence side. Now, after this, Salinger's unit was sent to Luxembourg, where they worked to clear out Nazi spies. Then his unit helped liberate the Kaufering 4 concentration camp, which was one of 11 sub-camps surrounding the main Dachau concentration camp. Kaufering Lager 4, which was named the Krankenlager, was intended to be a camp for the sick of the other 10 camps. It was still an extermination camp in the sense that they did not provide any medical attention whatsoever. And the inmates that were sent there were sent to die of their sicknesses or from starvation. Salinger said to his daughter, "You never really get the smell of burning flesh out of your nose entirely, no matter how long you live." He didn't write much more about his experiences that day, but we have the account of another U.S. Army colonel who was there the same day with him, liberating the same camp, a colonel named Julian Sachs. He said, "We entered and looked around. We were so shocked at what we saw that we couldn't say a word. I walked down one of the short streets and counted 65 bodies lying in ditches. The bodies were very emaciated, probably weighing no more than 50 to 75 pounds, and had been starved to death. Many of the bodies had sores, as if the skin had contracted and cracked. The smell of death filled our nostrils. It was much worse than any of the pictures show, because pictures don't show the odor or the sores on the bodies." At this camp, they found mass graves, buildings burned, filled with people inside, and corpses everywhere. Nearby, there was a train that had been filled with 800 prisoners before being sent back to the main camp at Dachau. At the last minute, the train was riddled with anti-aircraft guns before the camp was liberated. Now, if we were to go off of the war crimes trial, we would know that Salinger would have seen at a minimum 86 prisoners burned to death and something like 274 corpses who had been shot or burned, you know, separate from the train I just mentioned. Now, other people liberating the main camp or at Buchenwald saw larger numbers, but you get the point. Very curiously, witnessing the Kaufering concentration camp did not seem to change Salinger's mind about the Nazis, who he curiously still seemed to hate less than his comrades in arms or the average American. It did not change his growing anti-war position. But after the war, 2 months later, Salinger suffered a nervous breakdown, almost certainly in response to what he saw that day. Now, Salinger's symptoms do not match combat fatigue, nor had he seen much combat, so a nervous breakdown would be the more accurate term. And the modern diagnosis of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is generally what most people believe that he had. The DSM says that most people who have PTSD also have other psychiatric disorders, such as major depressive disorders. And it is believed that Salinger might have had two related personality disorders. Like, I'm not a huge fan of, like, trying to say that, like, Napoleon, you know, had depression, or, like, trying to, like, you know, diagnose people from the distant past. But with Salinger, it's not so distant, and we do have quite a bit of evidence for these things. So this isn't really a stretch in my book. But people believe that Salinger had two related personality disorders: avoidant personality disorder and or a borderline personality disorder, with avoidancy being the more pronounced element. He was a reclusive author, right? Avoidant personality. Now, Salinger wrote to Ernest Hemingway about his breakdown, actually. and he explained why he went to seek psychiatric help. Salinger said, "I've been in an almost constant state of despondency, and I thought it would be good to talk to somebody sane." Now, interestingly, Salinger chose to go to a civil hospital rather than a U.S. Army hospital, because he said, "I had to give my right arm to get out of the Army, but not on a psychiatric, this man is not fit for Army life ticket." I can't help but imagine that he also probably didn't trust the U.S. Army all that much, which, having been involved in cover-ups for the Army, I can kind of understand that. But maybe not his actions from this point on. Let's take a break and then get into it. Now, you guys want to get weird? Like, really weird? Let's get pretty weird. So in July 1945, J.D. Salinger went to get psychiatric help in a civilian hospital in Klinikum Nord, which at that point was called the Municipal General Hospital in Nuremberg. Now, the director of the psychiatric clinic at this hospital was named Dr. Ulrich Fleck, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi. He had been a stormtrooper doctor for the paramilitary SA from 1933 on, and he had been a Nazi Party member from 1937 on, and he was involved in various Nazi Party organizations as well, right? I don't know about you, dear listener, but I love to get that sense of impending dread at each sentence. Now, we don't know what crimes Dr. Fleck was directly responsible for, because there was no investigation, not because there was no evidence. But we do have a letter that he wrote to a colleague, saying, "It is true, after all, with some patients who have been retarded since birth, one thinks again and again it would be almost more humane to end their lives." Now, of course, in Nazi Germany there were mass executions of retarded people, the mentally ill, and the incurably sick in Nazi Germany. It is very likely that Dr. Fleck was, at a minimum, a participant in these programs, both due to his beliefs, his affiliations, and his position. Anyway, due to his position and, you know, his rank in the Nazi Party, Dr. Fleck would have been on the Army's automatic arrest list, which was carried out precisely by CIC. But instead of arresting him, Salinger was in fact his patient at his clinic. Salinger was treated by Dr. Fleck for 2 months before the CIC arrested him in September of 1945. Now, Salinger wanted to talk to someone sane, but instead he was treated by a hardcore Nazi psychiatrist, someone who, at a minimum, probably signed off on the murder of mentally ill and disabled patients, you know, to say who knows what else he might have gotten up to. Now, I'm not saying that J.D. Salinger was brainwashed by a committed ideological Nazi psychiatrist, but I'm not saying that. And you got to admit, like, while I'm not saying that Salinger should get an automatic pass for his later erratic behavior and mental illness, you gotta admit this doesn't help, right? Like, at a minimum, there was a Nazi psychiatrist in a position to have brainwashed him if they wanted to. Dr. Fleck was arrested but not prosecuted. He later went on to run a private practice, and then he became a professor for, guess what? Forensic psychiatry and drug addiction. In the words of my buddy Dimitri, cool, you love to see it. Now, Salinger was having what he called borderline treasonous thoughts before he entered the clinic. And to be fair, it doesn't seem like his personality changed drastically after the clinic. Like, he was sick before, and he was sick after. He was reflexively against the war before, and he was after. He was weirdly not against the Germans and the Nazis before, and he was weirdly not against the Germans and Nazis after. So, like, one check against the possibility that he was suddenly brainwashed, I suppose. In a letter to his friend, Elizabeth, J.D. Salinger wrote about his own little war over here, and he said, "It will go on for some time." It's not at all clear what he meant by his own little war, whether that be depression, or his intelligence work, or what. But then Salinger wrote, "My most casual thoughts over here are edgy with treason. It's a mess, Elizabeth. Wonder if you have any idea." It makes you wonder what he's talking about. In the same letter, Salinger wrote that he was delighted that he had missed the VE Day celebrations in the United States. Then Salinger explained what he did on the day Germany surrendered. He said, "I celebrated the day wondering what close relatives would think if I fired a 45 slug neatly but effectively through the palm of my left hand, and how long it would take me to learn to type with what was left of my hand." Now I guess would be a good time to discuss Salinger's relationship to the Holocaust. Like, his fictional character, Seymour Glass, is more or less a stand-in for Salinger himself. Seymour Glass also witnessed the Holocaust. He wrote a short story called A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, where Glass is discharged from the army and then kills himself. In the course of the story, Seymour Glass revealed his admiration for German literature when he sent his wife a book of German poems, saying, "The poems happen to be written by the only great poet of the century." The poems are in German, so Seymour tells his wife that she should have bought a translation or something, or learned the language. Like, I'm not endorsing a vigorous hatred of Germans, but you have to admit, this is not normal Jewish American behavior, even for a Jew who's ashamed of being a Jew, right? Like, I understand that there's a wide spectrum of complicated feelings in the Jewish American community, but this is just downright bizarre. Now, PTSD is known to cause personality changes, presumably all the more so if they're treated by, say, a Nazi psychiatrist that, you know, Salinger should have been hunting down, right? And the story just gets more complicated from there. So, Salinger was treated by a Nazi psychiatrist. Then he went and married a Nazi physician. You know, normal things Jewish American men do after fighting in World War II and then witnessing the Holocaust.
Il s'est levé à mon approche, debout il était plus petit. Je me suis dit, c'est dans la poche, ce mignon-là, c'est pour mon lit. Il m'arrivait jusqu'à l'épaule, mais il était râpé comme tout. Il m'a suivi jusqu'à ma piole, et j'ai crié, vas-y mon loup. Fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 envoie-moi au ciel. Zoom, fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 moi j'aime l'amour qui fait boum.
Il va lui faire mal, il va lui faire mal, il va lui faire mal, il va lui faire mal.
Il n'avait plus que ses chaussettes, des belles jaunes avec des raies bleues. Il m'a regardé d'un œil bête, il comprenait rien, le malheureux. Et il m'a dit l'air désolé, je ne ferai pas de mal à une mouche. Il m'énervait, je l'ai giflé et j'ai grincé d'un air farouche. Mais fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 je suis pas une mouche. Fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 moi j'aime l'amour qui fait boum.
Vas-y, fais-lui mal, vas-y, fais-lui mal, vas-y, fais-lui mal, vas-y, fais-lui mal.
Voyant qu'il ne s'excitait guère, je l'ai insulté sauvagement. J'y ai donné tous les noms de la terre et encore d'autres bien moins courants. Ça l'a réveillé aussi sec et il m'a dit, arrête ton char, tu me prends vraiment pour un pauvre mec. Je vais t'en refiler de la série noire. Oh, tu me fais mal, Johnny, 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 pas avec les pieds. Si, tu me fais mal, Johnny, 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 j'aime pas l'amour qui fait bing.
Il lui a fait mal, il lui a fait mal, il lui a fait mal, il lui a fait mal.
Il a remis sa petite chemise, son petit complet, ses petits souliers. Il est descendu l'escalier en laissant une épaule démise. Pour des voyous de cette espèce, c'est bien la peine de faire les frais. Maintenant j'ai des bleus plein les fesses et plus jamais je ne dirai, fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 envoie-moi au ciel. Non mais fais-moi mal, Johnny, 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 moi j'aime l'amour qui fait boum.
Oh Johnny.
Oh la vache. Oh j'en ai marre alors.
Now, dilettantes, people who only dabble in knowing about Salinger's life, don't understand how deep this goes, but this is such a weird aspect of the story. We know that Salinger's wife was German for a bunch of reasons, but first and foremost, Margaret Salinger, his daughter from his second marriage, said that the woman that he married, Salinger's first wife, her name was Sylvia Welter. His daughter said that she was German and had been a minor Nazi party official, though from the records we have, she was not in the party. Not to say she wasn't, but we don't have record of it. Now, Salinger married Sylvia Welter while he was living in Germany, continuing his counterintelligence work. Basically, they just took the entire corps and gave them the option of staying longer because counterintelligence work doesn't go away when the war ends, like, you know, most army activities. Or like many army activities, right? So, after his CIC assignment ended, they moved to New York City where Salinger's family got to meet the new wife. Now, according to Doris, J.D. Salinger's sister, the family knew Sylvia was very German right away because of the way she spoke, saying she had a sharp, incisive way of speaking. Then Margaret, Salinger's daughter, said that Sylvia hated Jews almost as much as Salinger hated the Nazis. Mind you, she wasn't born yet. She was quoting a relative who remembered this. Margaret also said that Salinger had married her only because she had bewitched him. Bewitched him, huh? Bewitched. Bewitched. So, who is Sylvia Welter? Her birth certificate shows her to be German. She was born in Frankfurt in 1919. Her parents moved to Switzerland for a decade before they before they moved back to Germany. She attended a school in Nuremberg. She graduated in 1938. Sylvia spoke fluent French. Now here is the kicker. Listen closely, dear listeners. Over a six-year period, Sylvia attended six different universities before she received her doctorate in medicine. She was in residency when she met J.D. Salinger. On the city registry, she was listed as a German citizen, but on their marriage certificate, it says she's French. Now, if she were German, there were army regulations specifically preventing marriage to Germans. Men in the army could marry French women, but not German, so that's what they pretended. They also pretended she was French for the sake of his family, but his family was not fooled. Like, what the hell, this is a German woman you brought home. And like, think about it, what Jewish American man is marrying a German woman after World War II? Now, how did they get around this in the first place? Like, how did they literally pull it off? Because you're not supposed to be able to marry German women, right? Well, the CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, they were the ones in charge of issuing identification papers to displaced persons, which is to say, like the normal work being the thousands and thousands of slave labor inmates who needed papers to be able to travel back to, like, Eastern Europe for the most part. And Salinger just took one and forged her a French passport. She still had that French passport among her belongings when she died. Now, for a variety of reasons, Salinger's marriage to Sylvia Velter failed, and they had the Family Court of Queens County, New York, annul their marriage on January 26, 1949, at Salinger's request, citing deception, and of her having married him under false pretenses. The annulment decree does not state what the nature of the deception was, but one Salinger biographer, a different one, documented that one of Salinger's college friends told him that Salinger had the marriage annulled after, quote, he found out some disturbing things about what she did in the war, specifically with the Gestapo, unquote. Now, there is no concrete proof that Sylvia worked for the Gestapo. In fact, there's not much concrete evidence that anyone ever worked for the Gestapo, because their standard practice was to burn their files before, you know, they lost the war. But, if you'll recall, she attended six different universities over 6 years, but it never slowed down her education at all. And we know that the Gestapo was heavily monitoring their student population. For instance, in 1942 and 1943, the Gestapo arrested the White Rose Movement, among others, and executed them. Like, most famously, there was Hans and Sophie Scholl, right? But for years and years before that point, they had been spying on their students, including at the University of Munich, which was one of the six schools that Sylvia attended. What's more, J.D. Salinger actually wrote a short story called For Esme, where Salinger's alter ego, the CIC agent, the character Sergeant X, is stationed at the army occupation in a small Bavarian town, just like with Salinger and Sylvia. Shortly after taking up his duties there, the fictional Sergeant X arrests the 38-year-old unmarried daughter of the family that had been living in the house requisitioned as living quarters for Sergeant X's CIC detachment. He arrests this woman because she had been a low official in the Nazi Party, but high enough by army regulation standards to fall into an automatic arrest category. And in the story, they get married. So, just like with the Nazi psychiatrist who, you know, was in position to brainwash him, we have no hard proof that J.D. Salinger married a Nazi spy. But we have quite a bit of evidence to think it was at least possible. Now, what happened to Sylvia? After their divorce, she stayed in America. She married a different American man, and they moved to Hendersonville, North Carolina, where she set up practice as an ophthalmologist. For the rest of her life, she claimed and insisted that she was French. Now, like I mentioned before, after the war, Salinger signed up for 6 more months of denazification with the Counterintelligence Corps before he got out and, you know, really make a literary career. Now, this work changed after the war. During the war, it was all about rounding up spies and saboteurs, at least theoretically. And after the war, the work became focused on locating high-ranking SS and Nazi Party officials who were trying to avoid responsibility for their war crimes. Now, in terms of denazification, they used the following classification system. There's 1 through 5, 1 being major offenders, 2 being activists, militants, and profiteers, or incriminated persons, 3 being less incriminated, 4 being followers or fellow travelers, and 5 being exonerated or non-incriminated persons. Obviously, you might expect that the majority were either outside of the bounds or were in Category 4 as followers, right? And all of the major offenders, Category 1, were either killed or killed themselves or were arrested. So the bulk of his work entailed locating Level 2 offenders, which is to say activists, militants, and profiteers or incriminated persons. And the way this actually worked was that the CIC basically needed to recruit German informants to tell them who and where these people were. Now, it's not as well documented for reasons you might imagine, but CIC work at this time also entailed scooping up Nazis for Operation Paperclip. And at a bare minimum, Salinger would have known about it, if not actually helped carry it out. Which is to say also that Salinger would have known enough to know why denazification was a joke. Now, Salinger was either uninterested or unengaged in this work. He was doing it at a lower level, of course, and he viewed it as something of a joke. And I'm not sure if he felt it was a joke in ways that I would agree with or not, but, I mean, either way, Salinger wrote letters back home making fun of Nazi hunting. One letter to Ernest Hemingway said, "There are very few arrests left to be made in our section. We're now picking up children under 10 if their attitudes are snotty." Now, this makes me think about the Krupp trial and how the defense, the Krupp's defense, was that the whole thing was an overzealous prosecution by Jewish Americans. And I am struck by how atypical this dismissive attitude would have been for J.D. Salinger to have. To wrap up Salinger's war experiences, I will quote from the Olson book again. "There is inarguably something wrong with the judgment of a World War II soldier who dislikes the U.S. Army more than he does the Nazis, and who sees nothing wrong in bringing a German wife home to live with him in the household of his Jewish family." This was more than bad judgment. Salinger's family must have felt that he had undergone a personality change, unquote. But, over and over again, Salinger just doesn't seem to mind the Nazis, and he absolutely hated the United States Army. The war weariness and anger at the Army, like, that makes sense. Like, Catch-22 levels of disgust at the Army make sense. Vonnegut's, like, distaste for the U.S. Army, or at least some of its actions, make sense. But this lack of judgment about the Nazis makes no sense at all. Some have speculated that this was a defense mechanism, but who knows?
Petals and leaves, feelings for blue. Everything grows from the mirth you planted in me. Entangled with you, sleeping at your house, brushing our teeth, lying on the floor in my
Sometimes we tap our fingers in Morse. You drum on my knee, down to these things within me. You make me forget my manner and down. I used to take pride.
After the war, Salinger went on to write Catcher in the Rye and more short stories, and he became more and more reclusive. Now, Salinger got into Zen Buddhism in like the 1940s, like before the war had even ended, which is a very curious time to get into Zen Buddhism, I guess you could say. I'm not saying that an interest in Zen Buddhism is inherently sus, but it's very weird to be an American at war with Imperial Japan and to get into Zen Buddhism at that time. And I've already mentioned I'm not a huge fan of relying too much on psychiatry to explain figures from history. Like I've already said that. But I do think it is almost certain that Salinger suffered from both PTSD and avoidant personality disorder. Now, avoidant personality disorder is really interesting. It causes hypersensitivity to negative evaluation, and individuals with this disorder avoid making new friends unless they are certain they will be liked and accepted without criticism. If someone is even slightly disapproving or critical, they may feel extremely hurt. As a result, these individuals may become relatively isolated. Now, Salinger's decision to stop publishing and to hide from the public in rural New Hampshire can therefore be explained as a natural result of this hypersensitivity to criticism. His sister, Doris, confirms this. She said, "Not publishing all these years, what a crazy business. It's because he can't stand any criticism." I quote from the Olson book, "In addition to an avoidant personality disorder, Salinger seems to have been afflicted with a borderline personality disorder. Despite its name, borderline personality disorders do not hover on a borderline between two other psychiatric disorders, but have their own unique set of symptoms. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the most prominent symptom of borderline personality disorders is a pattern of unstable and intense personal relationships characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation. Other symptoms are co-occurring depressive disorders." Salinger, of course, had all of that, like he fit it to a T. Probably driven by these problems, Salinger got into Kriya Yoga with his second wife. She seems to have committed to it, but she said that Salinger would regularly leave their home to go work on a story for several weeks, only to return with the piece he was supposed to be finishing all undone or destroyed, and with Salinger finding some new ism we had to follow. Around this time, J.D. Salinger got into Dianetics, and he even met L. Ron Hubbard. According to Salinger's daughter Margaret, after Dianetics, they tried out Christian Science, Edgar Cayce, homeopathy, acupuncture, and macrobiotics. Later on in Salinger's life, he got into Sufi mysticism in the vein of Idris Shah. Then he dabbled in Taoism. Then he went back to Vedanta and yoga. Let's talk about the Maynard affair. In 1972, the 53-year-old Salinger began a relationship with an 18-year-old woman named Joyce Maynard. At least, that's the story of when they began their relationship. Their relationship ended badly, and in 1998, Maynard wrote a memoir detailing her time with Salinger, which was controversial to say the least. Now, I feel like it doesn't have to be this way, but a lot of the time when people talk or write about, like, Me Too stuff, it ends up being like people writing about Jesus Christ, in that when you write about it, you end up revealing far more about yourself than the ostensible topic you're supposed to be talking about, right? I'm going to try to avoid that personally, and it is not my intention today to cancel J.D. Salinger for clearly grooming this poor girl. But at the same time, of course, she was also an adult who pursued him. There was definitely a power imbalance for sure, and Salinger comes across like a huge bastard in her memoirs. And for the most part, I believe her. Like, there aren't that many reasons to doubt her, right? Now, when the book came out, they had a discussion that mostly trashed Maynard. And I think that at the time, she was treated more poorly than she deserved. And she was somewhat vindicated years later when the culture changed and more people were realizing how fucked up it is for like a 53-year-old famous author to like basically sexually prey upon like a young 18-year-old, right? But at the same time, there are questions in her story, not doubting the relationship, because it definitely happened, not doubting her abuse, but doubting perhaps some of the details. And she and her family really seem to be a piece of work. I will touch on that, right? The thing that really gets me, though, is that there are some very strange details to the Maynard story that she wrote about that do not get remarked upon when people talk about J.D. Salinger and Joyce Maynard. Let's get into it, and I will explain what I mean. I will attempt to be both brief and chronological. So Joyce Maynard grew up in Cornish, New Hampshire, which is where J.D. Salinger lived. There's also a famous art colony there, but more for like, you know, painting, not for literary works for the most part. Now, according to the story that Maynard gives, they never met until later. I question this to a degree, but I have no way of disproving it, so what are you gonna do? So, Joyce Maynard attended Phillips Exeter Academy. Like, if you were to go through the full alumni of Phillips Exeter, like, you would see just the most ridiculous list of people. Like, there's a long list of politicians. There's George Plimpton in the literary scene. Mark Zuckerberg went there. Arthur Schlesinger, Gore Vidal, Roxane Gay. Like, a long, long list of the power elite, such as it is. Now, Maynard had written for 17 magazine before she had, like, gone to college. Maynard was attending Yale, right? And in her first year at Yale, J.D. Salinger saw what I can only call a bizarre full-page photo and article in the New York Times entitled, "An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life." Like, Supposedly, this article was part of an essay contest that she won, you know, through writing the best essay. But, I mean, if you're on the premium side of Program to Chill, you know that the publishing industry is not a meritocracy, right? Maynard was clearly being groomed for some kind of literary career, and or her parents bought it, you know. It's a complicated interplay between the two, as you might imagine. And from this article, Salinger began grooming her as well, because he wrote to her, and they began to correspond while she was at Yale. Now, Maynard includes this curious passage in her memoirs. Jerry, that's J.D. Salinger, Jerry has told me at some length in his letters about his many years-long study of homeopathic medicine. In almost every letter, there is some reference to a day spent treating one or other or another of his children. Now, in one of my letters, I mentioned that on a bike ride in the countryside around New Haven, I've picked up a case of poison ivy. 2 days later, a little package arrives, a remedy he's fixed for me. Spotted jewelweed saturated in high-proof vodka. I use it right away, and the poison ivy's gone. No surprise. Jerry Salinger has secret powers, greater than any person I've ever known. J.D. Salinger has secret powers, greater than any person I've ever known. So, Joyce Maynard never elaborates on this, but it's a weird discordant note to include. You could chalk it up maybe to literary flourish, but like, I don't know, man. There's another weird detail that normally gets left out when people talk about Joyce Maynard. Get this. Get this, dear listener. She was invited to audition for the lead role in The Exorcist, but lost out to Linda Blair. Now, The Exorcist, of course, was written by William Peter Blatty, a spy, to tie it back to the topic at hand here. But I don't know what to make of that. Like, invited to audition is not exactly how the typical Hollywood experience goes, right? But maybe we can get even weirder by continuing to look at her life. So, the way she tells the story, Salinger convinced her to drop out and come live with him. But that's not quite how it happened. Maynard went to visit him on a school break from Yale. Mind you, she's living in Cornish. She's, you know, she's in the same town as he is. So, I'm not sure I believe them that they've never met before, but that's what they say, so we go with it. Now, in her memoirs, she wrote, she described getting ready for her first time meeting J.D. Salinger. And it is not wrong to characterize this as a date. She told her parents, this is the passage. I have tried to imagine what was going on in my parents' minds as they picked me up from the bus from Yale before I made my trip to Cornish. Nobody suggests this is a bad idea or questions what might be going on in the mind of a 53-year-old man who invites an 18-year-old to come and spend the weekend. My mother is very proud that I have attracted the attention of such a famous and brilliant man. And she is something else, excited. In just a few weeks, my mother will turn 50, an age that might have been appropriate for receiving the attentions of a 53-year-old. At the same time, her own sexual and romantic life seems finished, although certainly her interest in sex and romance is far from dormant. For years, she has lived vicariously through her daughters, seldom more than she does now. Up in my bedroom, surrounded by the bookshelves, in which my Barbies were set up just a couple years ago, she and I lay out the pattern pieces for a dress we will make together for my trip to Cornish, just as, the fall before, we sewed up a dress for my trip to the White House, and my Julie Nixon Eisenhower interview. As with our last sewing project, she speaks of the outfit we're making as a costume. This time I dress the part of the child innocent. The dress we make is nearly exactly the same as the one I wore to my first day of first grade. The fabric we choose was probably designed for the curtains on a child's room, stiff white broadcloth, printed with ABCs in bright primary colors. The style, the same one we used when we made my dress for my first day of Yale, is so simple we don't even need to buy a pattern. It's a sleeveless A-line shift, fastened at the shoulders with oversized mother-of-pearl buttons, so all I have to do putting it on is raise my hands and slip it over my head the way a child would do. The dress is very short with giant solid color broadcloth pockets onto which my mother appliques alphabet letters cut from the printed fabric, A on one pocket, Z on another. I am so thin and flat-chested, the dress requires no darts. I wear it with purple Mary Jane style flats, unquote. Like, I completely agree with her. Her parents are absolutely insane for not questioning this at all. Then she describes her costume, describing her as an innocent child in order to basically seduce Salinger. And how perverse is it to describe the dress as nearly the same as the one for her first day of first grade? Wasps are deeply, deeply diseased, to use the famous Trilbilly motto. Now, when the memoir came out, these details were used to disparage Maynard for clearly having sought a relationship with Salinger. And like, up to a certain point, they have a point. I am not shaming her for seeking interest in Salinger. I'm shaming her parents for being this deranged, and of course for Salinger for pursuing, you know, an 18-year-old, right? Now, as the story goes, eventually Maynard dropped out of Yale to be with Salinger, and I mean, like, moving right in to live with him. As you might guess, her memoir includes a lot of prurient details about their sex lives. For the morbidly curious, you can go look it up yourself. I'm going to skip it, mainly because it's not directly relevant to the story at hand, right? In general, though, and speaking of their time living together, Maynard wrote, "He told me what movies to watch, what music to listen to, what food to eat. Jerry told me what to think and write and not write, what was real and what was false. He told me who to be, and because I adored him, I wanted to be that person." She also said that while he aspired to know a lot about world culture and religions, he had blandly ignorant views of most cultures based on the movies he watched. You know, kind of like you would expect of a 53-year-old World War II veteran, even though he's a famous and reclusive author. Interestingly, though, she also said, "Over the years that followed, I heard from well over a dozen women who had a similar set of treasured letters from Salinger in their possession, written to them when they were teenagers." Salinger was a serial groomer, according to Joyce Maynard. And considering that no one disputes that their relationship was real, I don't really see any reason to doubt her on this. For what it's worth, I believe Joyce Maynard about all of this. But I do not think that she is a good person, separate from her basically being abused by Salinger, or at least treated poorly, right? In 2010, Joyce Maynard adopted two Ethiopian girls. In 2011, she told friends and family she could no longer care for the girls and sent them to live with a family in Wyoming. Citing their privacy, she removed all reference to them from her website. It should go without saying that she sounds like literally a bad person for doing that. Now, this episode has been running long, but of course time flies when you're having fun, right? I could not live with myself if I didn't mention all of the weird things the Catcher in the Rye novel is connected with. First and foremost, there's Mark David Chapman, who in 1980 famously bought the book The Catcher in the Rye and wrote in it, "From Holden Caulfield to Holden Caulfield." He also wrote, "This is my statement." Then he shot John Lennon with a .38 revolver and then sat down on the street reading the novel. Now, I don't have time to cover the full Mark David Chapman story, but let me just sum it up in one word: brainwashed. Then in 1981, John Hinckley Jr. shot at President Ronald Reagan with a .22 revolver. The police found The Catcher in the Rye among several books he had in his hotel room. Again, I don't have time on this episode to do a deep dive on John Hinckley Jr., but you guessed it, brainwashed. In 1989, a man named Robert John Bardo shot the actress Rebecca Schaefer with a .38 revolver. He was carrying a copy of The Catcher in the Rye on him at the time, although he claims it was a coincidence. I mean, whomst among us does not keep that thing on me, meaning both a .38 revolver and a good book, for just when the murderous urge strikes. Supposedly, Lee Harvey Oswald owned a copy of the novel as well, though I was not able to get a good source to verify that claim. Further, the novel shows up in several works that are themselves very, very curious. The Catcher in the Rye is mentioned in the John Fowles novel, The Collector, where a man kidnaps a woman. The woman, in captivity, recommends that the man read the book in order to understand empathy, but the man, being like a sociopath, doesn't understand it. The novel The Collector was itself owned and beloved by the serial killers Leonard Lake and Charles Ng, and Christopher Wilder and Robert Burdella. Then, in the 1980 Stanley Kubrick film adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining, the first time the characters Wendy and her son Danny appear, Wendy is in the kitchen smoking and reading the novel, The Catcher in the Rye, while Danny watches TV. This doesn't happen in the novel, so Kubrick added it. This would probably have a high degree of significance depending on your personal read on Stanley Kubrick. Finally, in the 1997 film Conspiracy Theory, Mel Gibson's character compulsively buys copies of The Catcher in the Rye, of which he owns dozens and dozens already, and the film shows it as a way for his handlers to track him. But what's up with this novel? Is there any reason to think that this novel, anything in it, like any strange resonances beyond the novel possibly just being used as a completely arbitrary trigger for someone who's already brainwashed and alienated? And like general themes of alienation, that's probably not enough, that like too many novels have that, right? So is there something special with this novel? I think so. For one thing, Holden Caulfield, the main character, in the course of the novel, he experiences a mental breakdown and ends up in a mental hospital. By the way, spoilers, but I don't really care. You know, either you should have read it by now or you shouldn't care about spoilers for this book. Now, there's a bunch of weird stuff in this novel that perhaps people don't catch. Like Holden Caulfield saying at the very beginning of the novel, "My parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father." Later there's this dialogue. Ostensibly, the discussion is about getting kicked out of school, but of course, there could be a deeper significance. "What did Dr. Thurmer say to you, boy? I understand that you had quite a little chat." "We did. We really did. I was in his office for around 2 hours, I guess." "What did he say to you?" "Oh, well, about life being a game and all, and how you should play it according to the rules. He was pretty nice about it. I mean, he didn't hit the ceiling or anything. He just kept talking about life being a game and all, you know." "Life is a game, boy. Life is a game that one plays according to the rules." "Yes, sir, I know it is. I know it." In a different scene later on, Holden Caulfield tries on a hat and says, "I took it off and looked at it. I sort of closed one eye like I was taking aim. This is a people shooting hat," I said. "I shoot people in this hat." Now, not to belabor the point, but obviously this would be a quite significant passage in a book that has been linked to multiple high-profile shootings. And of course, the one eye thing, why, you could take that in all sorts of directions if you were noited enough. Like, for instance, the all-seeing eye of Freemasonry, perhaps. Now, I read a long and somewhat convincing article suggesting that The Catcher in the Rye is filled with allusions to Freemasonry, and that the plot basically recounts Holden Caulfield's alienation with and reconciliation to what Caulfield calls this goddamn secret fraternity that I was too yellow not to join. That's right, Holden Caulfield joined a goddamn secret fraternity. I think that this arguably goes a lot further in explaining the enduring popularity of the novel among killers than I've ever seen before. There might be a lot more to it than either the government using it arbitrarily to trigger assassins, or that, like, all of these people are just weird alienated losers who just like art made for weird alienated losers, right? Like, that is part of it, but I think there's something else. Toward the end of the novel, Caulfield is haunted by graffiti saying, "Fuck you." He sees it all over the city. At times he would try to scrape it off the wall, but he kept seeing it. Caulfield went to a graveyard and saw it written on a tomb. He said, "That's the whole trouble. You can't ever find a place that's nice and peaceful because there isn't any. You might think there is, but once you get there, when you're not looking, somebody'll sneak up and write, 'Fuck you,' right under your nose. Try it sometime. I think even if I die and they stick me in a cemetery and I have a tombstone and all, it'll say Holden Caulfield on it, and then what year I was born and what year I died, and then right under it, it'll say, 'Fuck you.' I'm positive, in fact." And at the end of the day, that is the central message that secret societies have towards normal people. Fuck you. To finish, I will play a clip from the 2012 film Killing Them Softly, wherein Brad Pitt's character, the gangster hitman Jackie Coogan, goes to collect on his professional hits.
"To reclaim the American dream and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one."
You hear that line? Line's for you. Don't make me laugh. We're one people. It's a myth created by Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, now you never go with Jefferson, huh?
My friend, Jefferson is an American saint because he wrote the words, "All men are created equal." Words he clearly didn't believe since he allowed his own children to live in slavery. He was a rich wine snob who was sick of paying taxes to the Brits. So yeah, he wrote some lovely words and aroused the rabble, and they went out and died for those words. Well, he sat back and drank his wine and fucked his slave girl. This guy wants to tell me we're living in a community. Don't make me laugh. I'm living in America, and in America, you're on your own. America's not a country. It's just a business. Now fucking pay me."
And that's what America's all about. Fuck you, pay me. Especially and including its secret societies. And that is the grand exoteric message of Freemasonry. Fuck you, pay me. For sources today, I used the biographies J.D. Salinger: A Life by Kenneth Slowensky, as well as the book Salinger and the Nazis by Eberhard Olsen. I also used Joyce Maynard's memoir At Home in the World, as well as a variety of articles about her, mostly from the New York Times. I also used the novel The Catcher in the Rye, as well as the blog comparing it to Freemasonry, which was written by Joseph Atwell. Thank you for listening, dear listener. You are already on the premium side, so just tell a friend about the show. See you next week, and God bless.
Hello again, this is another original song of mine. There ain't nothing wrong with the rain. It is good to wash away the pain. Let the angels lead you to the light. Everything is gonna be alright. Love yourself when you are all alone. Even if alone is all you've known. if you